They know enough who know how to learn. Henry Adams made this declaration in 1892. He had no idea that in the 21st century, his words would be more true than ever. Compare this quote to one by Patrick Ray, a regional director of the United States Small Business Administration. In 2005, Ray said that the absolutely qualified high school graduate who can compete for a good job in the 21st century will be a Renaissance geek. That graduate will have a lifelong love of learning, both formal and informal, and the jobs of that graduate will likely need to be learned, unlearned, and relearned. Now, we'll define geek in its modern sense as a person who is extremely interested and knowledgeable about something. In this case, geek about learning. This facility of the Renaissance geek to know how to learn, or what we've dubbed the literacy to learn for the 21st century, is evolving while we speak. With each new tool, with every new application, we shape our technology and it shapes us, how we think, communicate, and learn. So the wise approach for us would-be 21st century skills explorers is to build a conceptual framework for teaching the literacy to learn, a framework that is sturdy enough to support us, but not so rigid as to hold us back. We need a framework that can grow with us as we develop a common language and set of concepts and principles. And so our teaching framework is based in large part on the work done by the Partnership for 21st Century Skills. North Carolina, a strong member of the USDLC family, has embraced the work of the partnership and is the first state to begin its own Center for 21st Century Skills. Our Literacy to Learn framework builds largely on the learning skills element, the information and communication technologies element, and 21st century tools element. But all of the elements are intricately interconnected. We'll demonstrate these concepts with vignettes from future mini classroom documentaries, some to be seen in this module and the others in modules to come. We'll also use a spiraling back, so you'll see these concepts or principles many times during the 10 modules, each time in a different light. Our first principle is the power of language. Language in a sense of different ways or modes of representation and communication. As the screen becomes our dominant source of information, so the image becomes our dominant mode of communication. It's important that students learn not only information literacy skills, but visual literacy skills, if they are to become facile at finding and interpreting the information they seek. And more, they need both linguistic literacy and visual literacy skills if they are to become effective designers of media messages. But we also know that all language carries often unseen emotional connections. And so we include here a type of literacy that is best known as critical literacy. We'll define critical literacy as a set of both literacy practices and civic competencies that help us understand that language, both verbal and written, represents particular points of view, and that often other points of views may be silenced. When we teach critical literacy, we're teaching students to read and think critically, but also to understand the power of language and to use that power wisely. Teaching critical literacy is how we propose to help students develop both multicultural literacy, global awareness, and civic literacy, all included in the 21st Century Skills framework. To illustrate this principle of the power of language, let's take a look at an exciting project that integrates technology and literacy in a way that opens up new opportunities for students to not only develop fluency in reading and writing, but also several of the critical inquiry practices that are vital for critical literacy. Specifically, finding an authentic voice and examining multiple perspectives. Nan Massengill students at Clayton High School in Johnston County, North Carolina, are learning both of those critical inquiry practices while doing the things that teenagers do best.
I want to be able to affect the kids that are not great readers, don't have a love for reading yet. I want to give them a place to really start to enjoy reading without being threatened. And I think this is a forum for that. They aren't threatened because they don't have to get into the middle of the classroom discussion. You know, they can actually have their own place for talking, and no one can say anything to them really about their opinion.
I'm a very shy person, and I was generally quite open with the whole thing. I had just moved here recently, so I was a little shy talking with the class and everything. But when I got online and got on the internet, it was a lot easier to express my opinion.
I think it does make you more open to what they have to say. I'm a pretty open person, and I would have said my mind to my friends or to them. But I think it did make me more open to what they said because I don't know them.
There's so many different ideas about it, and you really start thinking about, oh, wow, yeah, I didn't think about that. We have to analyze. We have to pick out certain and specific details of it, which is really difficult sometimes. But, you know, and when you go to post online, you actually want something good to say. You know, you don't want to look stupid. Oh, this is a good book. Oh, yeah. You want something significant, you know, something to remember you by.
Something to remember you by. There is that egocentrism in teens coming through. We usually think of cognition, and specifically metacognition and self-organizational skills, as being individual activities. But Vygotsky's work on apprenticeship learning has shown us the dynamic quality of working with others who can serve to scaffold or support our own thinking and learning. And that mentoring or support need not always come from a teacher. Let's look in on Anthony Swearingen's classroom at Hillside High School in Durham, North Carolina, where he uses the reciprocal teaching strategy to create a classroom of mentors and apprentices. His goal is to work from large group to small group and then to individual competence and confidence in thinking and self-organizational skills.
This really gets the metacognitive process flowing, using other students as a mirror for their own processes. And also, and I found, especially with low ability readers, that they're willing to take more risks in their learning because now they have a strategy and a structure for reading. And there's a lot of personal learning about really getting that metacognitive process out there and seeing how other people read and respond to a text and reflecting on that as a piece of personal learning, that this person saw it this way and I see it this way, and why is that true?
Okay, you want them to die, but you want them to work for you first. You're not going to kill them right away. But not all of them will be a doctor.
No, when you're checking the health of the people, you're trying to see what where they're going to be in the concentration camp. And whether or not they weak enough to die soon to get there.
So they just live up by health.
If you kidnap somebody who's already ill, who's going to die anyway, you're going to throw them in here, and you ain't going to feed them or nothing. You're going to be like, hey, he's going to die anyway.
Where we are right now, they've already been through evaluations or whatever. They're in the concentration camp now, so why is there still need to see a doctor? That's what I don't understand.
They gonna send you to the other question, the bad one. They gonna kill you.
There are other skills, abilities, and dispositions to be gained from social learning that are incredibly important in the development of 21st century skills. The textbook term is social constructivism, but the simple concept is that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, and that we can think more deeply and creatively when we collaborate. Mortimer Adler's Padea Seminar is one effective way to encourage cognitive development through social learning. Let's listen as Dr. Terry Roberts, director of the National Padea Center, debriefs after a sixth grade seminar.
A Padea Seminar is a formal dialogue about a text. They're always based on a text of some sort that is facilitated, in this case, by Neely, through open-ended questions about the text. And Neely, of course, very adroitly asked a number of questions during the seminar, and in some instances addressed questions to specific kids or groups of kids. Basically, the way the seminar is supposed to function is that it gives kids an opportunity to both think and speak for themselves, and in doing so, become more literate thinkers, more literate readers, more literate speakers, in this case about literature, but it could have been math or science, or social studies. The last thing I'd say is that there are really two sort of levels at which a seminar functions. One is social and one's intellectual. One of the things that I was very pleased to see today that I think we saw demonstrated, you know, in both periods was a certain level of intellectual civility and social grace. Now, I don't know how often you hear that applied to sixth graders, but in my mind, it was there.
I think that your truth doesn't have to be the truth. It can just be what you think about something.
Yeah, your truth doesn't necessarily have to be the same as what people think of the truth, because you could think the truth is wrong and have your truth being completely different.
I agree with Omni because it's kind of like your perspective of what you're trying to say instead of someone else's.
Yeah, I think like if you look at line 2 of stanza 2, it says with explanation kind, and kind can mean like varying or variety. So with explanation vary, like everyone's truth, their explanation of truth can vary and their own truths can vary person to person.
I'd say those sixth graders demonstrated intellectual civility. I'd also suggest that they demonstrate the true spirit of inquiry-based learning, which is what a life of learning is all about, being intellectually curious and open to creative inquiry and problem solving. This may be one of the richest gifts of technology, its contribution to individual and collaborative inquiry or problem solving. And it's also a great way for students to present their learning, offering new opportunities for learning performances. In Scott Ring's science classes at Ledford High School in Davidson County, North Carolina, students learn to present their learning in moving pictures and sound. Let's see how he uses movie making in the service of science learning.
Technology is such a great tool to use with kids. It gives those kids, you know, that aren't test takers, a different avenue to present their information and showcase what they know. It's a wonderful vehicle to showcase information and knowledge and learning. Sometimes we create the videos right in class. We'll work on a unit, and at our culminating project for the end of that unit will be to create a video that showcases what we know, what we have learned. So I'll give them the highlights as we go through things in class, and then they'll break down into groups, research that topic a little bit more carefully, really become the experts in that section, and then present that in a video. Other ways, when we're short on time, the kids will create the videos outside of school and then bring that footage in and work with it, edit it, and then piece it together, in class.
So do Scott's students make movies in a science lab or do science in a movie studio? Probably the former, because these students don't see the technology as a big deal. That's the beauty of growing up digital. The technology becomes transparent. It's like air, as one student described it. It's as natural as breathing and made all the more powerful when it makes that connection to the real world. Our final principle is real-world relevance, and it's all about linking learning and lives for now and the future. Our next teacher, middle school science teacher Carolyn Moser at Leesville Road Middle School in Wake County, North Carolina, shares a perfect example of how making that real-world connection is not only motivational for the now, but also sticks with students in future formal or informal problem-solving situations.
We just need to keep striving to work together and to solve problems, and that's what the work of science is all about. And hopefully students see the carryover of what we do through the scientific method into everyday problems that they have to work through, because they're using science all the time. They just don't realize it. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of going about solving problems, approaching problems in a systematic way. And I think this is a real important concept for students to learn.
Is anybody doing air temperature over there?
In the plan for the future, there is to be a park, a city park, built across the street from our school. In the study site project, they're going to actually have a hand in designing that park. And what better results for children to see than a park that they help design? I think that is real hands-on connections for children that they're just so valuable. I think that we are seen as educators that through helping others, there's a great benefit to children when they can see that they make an impact on their community, on their school, that they do count, that just because they're children doesn't mean that they don't have a voice. I think that we are making the connection between the learning and real life.
A final quote. Alvin Toffler, author of Future Shock, said the illiterates of the 21st century will not be those who cannot read or write, but those who cannot learn, unlearn, and relearn. Welcome to the 21st century. Welcome to Literacy to Learn.